Hello, welcome to the Citywire Funds Fanatic podcast. My name is Gavin Lumsden, and with me today, for the second time in 2 years, is Peter Spiller of Capital Gearing Trust. Peter, great to see you. Now, we're going to talk about inflation, which has, as you correctly predicted, surged from near zero the last time we spoke in August 2020 to 7%. But first, the other big thing that's changed recently is if you've achieved 40 years running the investment trust. So congratulations. How do you feel about notching up such a long tenure?
Well, it's been a lot of fun going. That's been the key feature of it. And it started off being fascinating and is still just as fascinating. But when I started in 82, it was really a great time for a fund manager to start to put together a record because inflation was elevated but falling. Interest rates were high but falling. Balance sheets were in terrific shape. And PEs were very low. So the market was on something like seven times.
And this is because the market's coming out of the terrible 1970s period of high inflation, low returns.
Well, the 1970s were indeed ghastly. But they did achieve some purging effects as well. So when Volcker was appointed to squeeze out inflation in 1979...
So this is the financial secretary?
The president, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. So he was appointed to defeat inflation almost regardless, whatever it takes. And the reason why he was able to do that without causing a depression was that the inflation of the 70s had eliminated large parts of the debt burden. So the body of the economy was able to take the medicine without severe effects. There was a minor recession. And that's all very different today, but you know, we'll get onto that.
Yes, but so now we're in the period of rapidly rising inflation and the central banks and the Fed are beginning to take steps to do that. But is the Fed... Do you think the Fed's hawkish enough to repeat what Volcker did? Are you you're looking forward to another Volcker moment? I understand.
Well, indeed, but first of all, the conditions are not yet right for a Volcker moment because of that debt point. So, for a very long period, essentially since the mid '90s, we've had very accommodative monetary policy, which has not produced inflation because of the very powerful forces for deflation coming from technology, democracy, but particularly from globalization. So the number of people involved in the capitalist market roughly doubled, and that huge increase in the supply of cheap labor kept the price of goods very low throughout. And central banks were therefore able to be very easy in their policy, without causing inflation. But what they did do, and I think history will not be generous to them or not noticing, was allow debt to increase to unsustainable levels. So the question, will the Fed be hawkish, is a very interesting one, because up until very recently, they were the very reverse, ultra dovish. And started to talk about targets like unemployment levels among disadvantaged groups, and that had to be very low before they would tighten policy. And that's just based on 25 years of there being no inflationary problem.
So they're very aware of their sort of social responsibilities.
Yes. Well, as they've got twin objectives. They've got inflation and growth. And that became reverse. So under Volcker, it was only the inflation that counted. And towards the end of 1921, it was increasingly clear that employment was the only thing that counted. And so the Fed was massively behind the curve when it came to tightening. And I think the correct way to look at it is that they became concerned that they were losing their credibility. And even people like Larry Summers were writing quite aggressive articles in the Wall Street Journal. And as a result of that, they have used very hawkish language in the last few months.
Is there a risk of them going too far?
Well, it's very interesting. So the answer is yes, but it's very interesting because I thought it was rather neatly put by something I read from J.P. Morgan's chief economist yesterday, where he was saying that they've gone from the New Testament, always forgiving, to the Old Testament to smite the economy until inflation is slain. As mentioned earlier, the second is not a viable policy, in my view, because with this amount of debt around, a reasonably deep recession runs the real danger of spiraling down into a depression. And I think they are very aware of that. And just to recall, for much of that 25 years when they were running their very easy policy, they used to refer to tightening episodes in the past, 1937 and others spring to mind, as mistakes. It was referred to as mistakes when they tightened too soon and too much. And then in 2018, in order to not repeat that same, quote, mistake, they turned around when financial conditions became quite tight. And on some measures, they are already as tight now as they were when they pivoted in 2018. Not on all. So there are some measures which say they have a bit to go, but I think we're getting reasonably close.
And we've seen stock markets fall, particularly yes. fully valued, highly valued
yes.
growth technology stocks. But, you know, has the US stock market, say, fallen enough? It's around down around 16%, I think, this year in dollar terms, less in sterling.
Right. Well, defined enough, but
Well, to bring it down to if it was overvalued before.
Yes.
How far does it have to fall to be?
So I think its overvaluation was a very big reason for the fall. There are all sorts of other things as well, but essentially it just got so overvalued it was not sustainable, and we have seen some really dramatic falls in Cathie Wood stocks, for instance, i.e. stocks where there's some undoubtedly huge promise sometime in the future, but no revenues now.
So the famous US fund manager, ARK fund manager, investing in internet right. and meme stocks.
Right. And I gather yesterday she bought General Motors.
Well, that's a turnaround.
It's certainly a turnaround. It looks awfully like capitulation, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
So that should be a positive, I suppose. But the long and short of it is that using Shiller's CAPE and Tobin's Q and so forth.
So CAPE is cyclically adjusted price to earnings?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And Tobin's Q measures book to price.
These are sort of long-term ways of assessing
absolutely.
Value.
They tell you nothing at all about timing. They say quite a lot about value. And to become good value on those grounds, we still got quite a long way to go. So the brief answer to your question is, I don't think we're there yet by any means. And, of course, the background is very unfavorable. So the debt, as mentioned, but also earnings are as high as they've ever been relative to GDP. And profit margins are very high because monopoly has been tolerated as a matter of policy for a long time. And those things are beginning to change. The real signs.
Politically,
yes.
And also on the expectation of sort of mean reversion, things revert back to
yes,
the norm.
Yes, and the labor share of GDP and so forth has been thoroughly depressed, is likely to rebound. So we're quite a long way from fair value on the S&P 500.
What about in the bonds market? Because, again, US government bonds have fallen very sharply as well in response to rising interest rates and inflation. You tend not to invest, you don't invest in conventional bonds, you invest in inflation-linked bonds.
Correct.
But, I was wondering whether you thought conventional bonds also look better value now that their prices have fallen and their yields have gone up.
Well, actually, just to point out, we do invest in conventional bonds as cash management, so very short, high-quality corporates, for instance, in the UK. Bonds have fallen, therefore, by definition, are better value than they were. But we have a very different view of the likely evolution of inflation compared to the markets. So if you look at the break-evens, the implied inflation rates are quite elevated in the short term.
Actually, I wonder, Peter, the break-evens is an important concept. If you could just quickly explain what they are, please.
As ever, it's more complicated, Gavin, than you might expect.
That's why I'm asking you to explain it rather than me.
So the yield on an index-linked bond can be parsed in the nominal yield of a bond of the same duration, same credit, and the break-even. And the break-even is normally defined as the expected inflation rate over the period of the bond. But I think it can be parsed further into the expected inflation rate over the life of the bond and a premium, an insurance premium, in case that expectation is too low. So what has happened in the UK on that reading of it is that actuaries have said to trustees of pension funds, there is no limit to that insurance premium that you should pay because it produces certainty that you can pay, meet your obligations in real terms.
You should hold them. You must hold them.
And the result of that, there isn't enough supply to satisfy that requirement for pension funds. And the result is that has been to push that premium very high, or to put another way, to push real yields down to what seemed to us quite extraordinary levels and extraordinarily unattractive.
So they're expensive, and therefore they're not as good as they might be indicating what inflation will be.
Well, the real thing is they're very expensive and distorted, so you're right on that point. But also they're very vulnerable to big falls in the short term. And indeed, we've seen very long UK index links fall 40% in the last few months.
So you've got about a third of capital gearing invested in these linkers, inflation-linked government bonds, but they're mostly US.
They're mostly US. So we do have some UK. I shouldn't mm-hmm. But what we have is very short UK index-linked bonds, so 22s and 24s we've earned over the last year. And they've been very satisfactory because the realized rate of inflation has been so much higher than the rate of inflation that had been baked into the prices a year ago. And they still look fine.
Right. And because their returns are linked to inflation is going up, they're going up.
But the thing is, because they're short, they weren't impacted by the rise in nominal rates anything like the same extent.
But so inflation-linked bonds have been behaving as you expect. I just asked the question because I was looking at a Vanguard tracker fund that tracks the UK linkers. And it's over a short-term time period, the first 4 months of the year. But it was down. And I'd have thought, that's the point at which inflation is clearly rising. I'd have thought they'd have done better.
Right. So before I answer that, which I will in a second, it is just worth observing that there are remarkable tax advantages accorded to individuals earning index-linked directly. So if it's for a taxable account for an individual, it makes much more sense to buy them
individually,
which you can do cheaply and so on. And you could buy the same duration as the fund. I think that would be fine. But having said that, as mentioned earlier, the makeup of a yield on a TIP or a UK index linked bond is made up of the nominal and the break-even or the expected inflation. And nominal bonds have been extraordinarily weak. So that element has pushed the price of index linked down. And it's, in a way, it's quite surprising because why are bond rates up? And the answer is because inflation is higher.
Exactly.
So you'd think the break-even would expand correspondingly. But we have always noticed that there's a significant lag. in that process. And therefore, you have to be quite careful if you're bearish of nominal bonds about the duration of your tips. Today, those break-evens, we can pull back into jargon for a moment, give you a reading for what the market expects inflation to be over different periods.
And so what are they saying?
And what they're saying is that inflation is transitory, just to quote the Fed's favorite word, or what used to be the Fed's favorite word, not as transitory as it was. So originally, by now, all would have been well. And to be fair, we have had a war which has made a very big difference, very big impact in the short term. But the idea was that much of the inflation was caused by shortages related to COVID, so shipping shortages, semiconductor shortages, all this sort of thing. And that would resolve itself, and after that, the inflation rate would go back to sort of 2-2.5%. And that thinking was correct. So we still expect that to happen. It turns out that the shipping problems and the semiconductor problems have lasted much longer than was anticipated then. But nevertheless, in a year's time, I think it's a reasonable assumption that these supply problems will have been sorted out.
So do you agree that inflation will subside then?
Yeah, right. Hang on a second. So they probably added 1%, shipping alone probably added 1% to inflation in the US, and that will be reversed over the next year, will be my guess.
So that's good.
That's good. Secondly, there's consideration of the base effects. So energy prices, oil prices have gone up a lot. And if they just stay the same, stay at that elevated level, then there's no inflationary impact in the forthcoming 12 months. So that also is helpful and will reduce the rate of inflation. The problem is that the inflation has been around for so long and is likely to stay around, particularly given the war, with its impact on food as well as energy, for wages to start to respond. And wages are by far the best indicator of ongoing inflation.
I see.
And so we've seen wages rise quite a lot. There's going to be some very interesting negotiations in the UK coming up. So nurses, for instance, I think the recommended increase is 3.5%, something of that kind. One nursing union has suggested that 12 would be a more appropriate level.
So you're reckoning the workers are not going to accept the argument that inflation is transitory. They're feeling it right now.
Right. And at a minimum, they want to be compensated for past inflation, an absolute minimum. But generally, just looking back over history, workers have always felt that they should be at least compensated for current inflation. And in fact, there are, I recall, academic studies done in the 70s, which demonstrated that people who didn't get a wage rise, which kept them whole, on the whole became demoralized and productivity fell. So there's every reason. But of course, I have sympathy with people settling wages now, because who knows what the inflation rate is? Is it the very high rate we're enjoying today? And which will peak again if the bank is right in the autumn, or is it the underlying rate, which is probably about half that level? But because of that change in globalization, particularly, and demography, as Goodhart has expounded, but particularly globalization, which it actually looks as though it's in reverse now, with the geopolitics as much as anything else, as well as the experience of COVID and the demonstrated benefits of short supply lines and so forth.
So companies are trying to produce their goods nearer to their home markets.
Yeah, had more control. But also there's ever greater reluctance to have reliance on China after the experience of what it's been like to have reliance on anything coming from Russia. So the underlying situation is dramatically different from what it's been in the years from, let's say, the early 90s to last year. And so to analyze it, it's probably better to go back to see how did markets and inflation rates behave in earlier periods. And I think the best illustration that we can find is that in the late 60s, so in 1965, President Johnson was elected in unfortunate, no, it wasn't elected actually, he moved into the White House in unfortunate circumstances on the death of Jack Kennedy. And he had a great ambition to do something for the poor. And he launched the so-called Great Society Program. So this is where Medicare and Medicaid were launched. And he inherited the Vietnam War. And because the war was so unpopular, he did not feel able to tax the population to pay for it, or pay for both. And
this is where the debt problem starts to emerge.
Well, it's where the overstimulation problem starts to emerge. So we'll get to the monetary policy later. But so in 1965, the budget was in balance. Inflation had been for 5 years between 1 and 1.5%. Unemployment had been falling. So actually, when he came into office, it was more or less at the Nauru, i.e. as low as it can get without causing inflation. And his policies overstimulated it, increased the budget deficit, and it blew out by nothing compared with where we are now, but to 2.5% of GDP. But that overstimulation of an already fully employed economy pushed inflation up by roughly 1% a year. So in the middle of the 60s, it was 1.5. By the end, it was 6. After that, obviously, it got much higher in the 70s. And we have as a basic background exactly that going on now. So forgetting all these special factors, the deficit, budget deficit, even for this year, and the economy is clearly fully employed, huge shortage of labor everywhere, and the deficit's forecast to be 4.8% if we get the slower growth that is quite widely feared, presumably to be greater. So we've got exactly the same thing, overstimulation on the fiscal front, and presenting the Fed with a really difficult problem.
So where do you think inflation could be going then, if it isn't as transitory because wage demands
start coming? As we were discussing, there are all sorts of things to push it down in the short term. So by the end of the year, it will be significantly lower than it is today. And so as we speak, it begins with an 8. I would expect it to be down to 4.5, 5 by the end of the year. But that's not on the way to the 2.5 that the market's anticipating.
I see.
After that, it keeps going, unless we have a major recession.
It keeps going sort of down or up?
No, it keeps going up. Mm. It recovers. It dips to that. But the market is assuming we will get some sort of minor recession, and that somehow will control inflation and control wages. I think the evidence for that, looking at past history, is quite insubstantial. So we anticipate, it's a very long way of answering your question, but we anticipate that at some stage investors will come to believe that inflation will be higher, and then break-evens will go significantly higher, and there'll be a significant capital gain on tips. So,
the Treasury index-linked U.S. government bonds are linked to inflation.
Yes, they're called Treasury inflation-protected securities.
Thank you.
Because there's another reason for believing inflation has to be quite high, which is that if you have excessive levels of debt, then there historically have been just two ways of solving that. One is to default on the debt, or to have circumstances where the creditors lose their money. And the other is to inflate it away with financial repression, as it's called, which is the state of play where inflation is high, but nominal interest rates are well below that rate of inflation. Because one way or another, the owners of the debt have got to lose. And the when you've got excessive debt, that process has to be sufficiently long or great to get debt into a better relationship with assets and incomes. So after the war, the World War, France had a huge debt. But they had a really quite alarming period for 5 years till 1950 where inflation was very elevated, got to 50%. But at the end of that period, they had dealt with the debt. And I can't help noticing that that period was followed by les Trente Glorieuses, the 30 years when the French economy grew remarkably.
I see. And that's kind of like the conditions in which you took over capital gearing all
well,
those
indeed.
Years ago.
Indeed. So,
but as we stand right now, your thesis has been sort of proved completely right, but there's more to go. You can see inflation rising. And therefore, the effect on stock markets is going to be further falls because they're not really anticipating that.
So inflation, they might be starting to now, but inflation historically has not been good for equities. Although I should refine that slightly. So if you take a full cycle from low inflation through high inflation to low inflation again, over the full period, you've done fine in equities. But it turns out that almost all the reward comes from the peak. And rising inflation has tended to be very bad for inflation, for markets, equity markets. I've been thinking about why that might be the case. Because certainly in the early stages, back in the 60s, looking back at that period, in the early stages of that inflation, equities did fine. Mm-hmm. They peaked in real terms in 1969. But I think it's because, as well as some effect on valuation, on PEs, because nominal rates tend to rise with inflation, there is also a recognition that it's going to require a recession to defeat inflation or to control it. And that itself inclines people to put a lower valuation on the earnings even while they're going up.
So are your positioned very defensively. You invest a third in these index bonds. You invested in property. Yeah, could you just tell us, remind us, what's your asset allocation and what it's trying to achieve?
Yes.
Because your philosophy is capital preservation. You want to preserve people's money in real terms after inflation, which clearly is going up.
Correct. So our allocation at the moment is 20% in what we call dry powder. That's to say, very short index-linked treasury bills, very short quality corporate bonds, and so forth, and cash. And then we have a third in, as you say, in index-linked of one form or another. So there's a bit of an overlap in this. And we have rather more in risk assets than you might imagine for someone with our rather pessimistic view.
When you're talking about shares and property, I think.
Yeah, property and alternatives and that sort of thing. And the reason why we've got a bit more in risk assets than you might expect is that if you go back to February 2020, we had 30% in risk assets because we thought values were very difficult to invest in. Obviously, March 20 threw up a lot more opportunities, and by the time we get to the end of the summer, we're 50% invested
in
risk assets.
Is a lot.
Still uncertain how things are going to work out. They have worked out much better than we could count on, we thought. And we're still about 44-45% in risk assets. And the reason why we've got much less in cash-like dry powder, much more investment, is the cash was then very limited in its losses from inflation. So the real value of cash didn't go down much, didn't move much. Whereas now, plainly, it does. So we have a lot of emphasis on trying to capture indexation of one kind or another in equity markets, so, or alternative markets.
Early this year, or end of last year, I think you increased your holdings in, for example, renewable infrastructure funds.
Yes.
And you like them because they're selling their... They've got index-linked, inflation-linked contracts to sell their power.
Well, some of them have, some of their revenues, they have indexation, which is indeed is very valuable. But they also have exposure to merchant power. And the war, actually Russia, I should say, not just the war, but Russia has transformed the outlook for power prices in Europe for some time to come, we think. So back in the summer, long before there was a war, Gazprom was not shipping gas for storage. So obviously, summer is a time of storage of power, of gas, and winter, you use those stores. So the inventories were very low going into the winter. And it seemed to us that Russia, having achieved a market share which was so high, roughly 40% of European gas, had discovered that they had power not unlike that of OPEC's in the oil market in the 1970s. They had sufficient market share that if they cut back supply just a little, they could raise the price a lot and making their total revenues higher. And the war obviously has exacerbated that a lot. So there are all sorts of plans for Europe to replace Russian gas, which they're doing as rapidly as they possibly can. So there's no criticism of that at all. But what they replace it with is going to be more expensive than gas was before all this process began.
There's been an estimate that it's going to cost Germany 12% of its GDP.
Right. Yes, these are big numbers, aren't they?
Huge.
But for us, just looking at the infrastructure stocks, the key point is that merchant power was always discounted at a much higher rate than those fixed index-linked cash flows which you referred to, with good reason, because they were very uncertain. But in these circumstances, we're pretty confident that the prices will be sustainably higher than it was before all this process began. Not necessarily as high as it is now, but it presumably has to fall from now, because then it looks absurd. But nevertheless, sustainably higher. And when you get those sort of cash flows being discounted at numbers like 8%, 8.5%, that starts to look very attractive.
Mm.
They've moved a long way in the last few months, so we've been very, very pleased with those investments. But I don't think the story's over yet.
Are you seeing any other opportunities in investment companies? Because discounts have been widening in recent weeks.
Yes. So we in fact, today we have bought quite a lot of an investment trust. I'm not going to mention which one it is again, because we're still buying it. But we do get circumstances where you get distressed sellers, and discounts are getting significantly wider. And we particularly like trusts where there are commitments that the discount will not be allowed to expand.
So the board will buy back shares? Or?
Well, it's where they say they will. Mm-hmm. So very often they're rather feeble about it. So they do indeed buy back shares. They don't buy back enough to prevent the discount from widening, which is quite contrary to what they said. I mean, they committed to a discount level, not that they would make a token gesture if discounts were wider. And we have been quite successful over the years to holding the feet of directors to the fire a bit, mm. and saying, look, you made a promise here, you need to keep it. That is much better for them, it's much better for the trust, it's better for everybody, it's certainly better for the shareholders. But also, of course, they make significant capital gains when they buy in at discounts and selling assets, obviously, at par.
And just thinking about your, you've criticised investors who have a naive ESG approach. So ESG being environmental, social governance. But you've taken a pop at investors who exclude oil companies from their portfolios.
Right.
And I think that's because you argue, and others argue, that they need capital support while we're going through this transition.
Well, I think the key thing is to decide what kind of an investor you want to be, one that improves the world or one that has marketing potential, because it's got nothing to do with anything that's...
And green fund sale.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw BP the other day. I think every second word was responsible. I mean, they really get the message, they behave in an excellent way. And think about a world where the ambition of some campaigners was met, and none of us would own BP or Shell, or we'd persuade them all to sell all their oil assets and gas assets. And what would happen? We still need oil and gas. So this is Pontius Pilate. I use the products, but I wash my hands of the process of getting it to me. But if you think about what will happen, is they all end up in the hands of presumably private equity, and a particular kind of private equity which has no qualms about what happens, and are presumably much less responsible than BP or Shell would be. So I think this is not an advance for the world. But the other thing is that if we electrify the world, we're going to use a lot more electricity. And the amount of oil demanded is forecast to be roughly where it is now for some time to come. But oil fields depleted about 5% a year. So it requires a lot of investment to stand still. And if we don't provide that investment, and the evidence is that is the investment in future supply is below that required, then the price will be very high. Now, if you're green, you might think that's great. But I think if you're a consumer, you wouldn't. So we need to be careful about what we wish for.
Absolutely. Getting towards the end of my questions, Peter, but just in terms of your performance, your aim is to, as I said earlier, is to give investors in capital gearing a real return after inflation. And you've done that over the long term. You don't necessarily beat the UK stock market, but it's a real return after inflation, and it's a less volatile performance than following the stock market index.
I suppose if I can be allowed to develop that answer a bit.
Of course.
We've always taken the view that when prospective returns in any given asset or asset class are good and risk is low, you should own that with the longest duration you can to lock in those returns for as long as possible. So back in 82, everything was good value, as I mentioned, and the longest duration asset was equities, and we owned all equities, didn't own anything else.
So back then, yes, capital gearing, which we think of as kind of owning these inflation-linked bonds and a bit of property and all the other things you've talked about, but back then you only owned shares.
Yeah.
So a very different beast.
Yeah. So if you fast forward to the end of the 90s, equity valuations were getting very rich, and we owned very little in equities. But bonds still offered fantastic value, including nominal bonds, so about 4.5% real, that sort of thing. So we owned a lot of bonds, including 30-year bonds and so forth, which is why we were able to sail through the crash of 2000 with an up year. And one of the things I'm proudest of about our record is that although the overall return has been quite satisfactory, so if you'd put £10,000 into the shares in 1982 and reinvested the income, who does that anyway? reinvested the income.
The theoretical investor.
You now have 2.8 million.
Wow.
So a long, long way ahead of the UK market.
Okay.
But the converse is also true. When prospective returns are very poor, then and risk is high, you want at least as little duration as you can possibly achieve. And that probably means very low weightings in ordinary equities. So I can't remember if I used the analogy last time we spoke, Gavin, but I think it's like Grandma's Footsteps.
I don't think you did. How do you mean?
Okay, so Grandma's Footsteps is a game where, which most people have played, not necessarily under that name, where Granny stands at the end of the lawn or the drawing room facing away from it. And small children line up at the other end. And they race, and the first person to touch her wins. But if she turns round and sees you moving, you're out. So any intelligent three-year-old works out pretty quickly that Granny never turns round twice in quick succession. So when she's just turned round,
you run as fast as you can.
Exactly. And then after a very short period, you're prepared to stop. And all I can say about current markets is that Granny hasn't turned around for a very long time.
Right. So, well, this brings me towards my sort of final question is, you know, what you're waiting for this big clear out, a Volcker moment, markets to fall even more, for inflation to erode the value of debts, and for, you know, companies to be cleansed. How long do you think that could be? And, you know, and will that be your final moment? Will you retire at that point once you've got this kind of, you know, complete revolution?
Right. So we don't know how long it'll be because, just to go right back to the beginning of our conversation, that process of the purging of debt, which happened in the 70s, has got to happen again before Volcker can be applied. If you applied Volcker's kind of policies today, you would get a depression. So the timing depends on quite how high inflation is. Obviously, the higher it is, the shorter the period it needs to exist for to achieve this objective. And we don't know what the makeup of that will be. So I think it's quite impossible to put timing on it. But it will be an uncomfortable period. If as you say, we get back to the conditions of 82, then PEs will be 7. At least they were then. So it's going to be really quite an uncomfortable period for assets and choppy waters to sail through. But fascinating, of course.
You're quite excited that your thesis might be panning out.
Well, I never get any pleasure from other people losing money. It's a competitive game, but our ideal is for us to do well and other people to do almost as well. Definitely not for them to be carried out on their sword. So it is very interesting. So when I will retire, I think will just be a function of when I no longer find it interesting. But what I would say about that is that whereas for periods of running capital gain trust, I've done it completely on my own, we now have a really high quality team, so that if I did retire tomorrow, I feel very confident.
The same process will continue.
That the trust will be at least as well run as it has been.
Okay. With me. Well, on that note, Peter, I'll say thank you very much. And maybe we'll get you back in 2 years' time and see if we're any closer to any of these Volcker moments or how we're going on this thesis. But clearly, so far, it seems to be going your way. And it's been a pleasure to hear you explain it all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gavin.